Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Gareth Mitchell. And today, they're calling it 2 years of college packed into just a weekend and possibly the best party you'll ever attend. Now, there's a tagline for a technology event. Our reporter is there. Meanwhile, a Silicon Valley grandee records his every waking moment and tells us how our biological memory is merging with computer memory. Total recall, indeed. And we're in Kampala looking for the next big thing from the brightest young things. And it's all on this edition of Digital Planet from the BBC. Breaking news from around the world. Earthquakes, shootings, political upheaval. It's all about being up to the minute these days. Well, now it seems even praying is topical. That's certainly the case for a monastery of nuns in the north of England. An unlikely addition to their otherwise sparse and meditative existence is a digital dot matrix display that gives a news feed of global events and updates of the emotions and feelings of bloggers around the world. Now, the object of all this is to help guide the nuns' prayer. The device's designers were originally working on technology for older people when they were then introduced to the nuns, elderly themselves, in fact the oldest, is over 100. But then the challenge became how to produce an object sympathetic to its monastic contemplative surroundings and yet easy to use and unobtrusive. Bill Gaver, Professor of Design at Goldsmiths University of London, has been telling me more about the device and the nuns who now use it.
They take vows of chastity, poverty, but also enclosure, so most of the nuns never leave the monastery. They have some contact with the outside world, so they listen to the radio. They even bought a computer a couple of weeks before the project began and have started using email and looking at some internet sites. But on the whole, they really withdraw from the world.
And your task, I suppose, was to bring something of the world to them and in a form, in a context that was acceptable to them, both aesthetically but also fitting in with their faith, I suppose.
That's right. Although they do withdraw from the world, they routinely make prayers of intercession on behalf of the people around them. So they actually are quite, in a sense, connected with the community. And they're concerned to keep their prayers pertinent, that is, up to date. And we thought we might be able to help them by creating a sort of specialized device to tell them about current concerns at a local and a global level.
Tell us about this device.
We call it the Prayer Companion. They call it Goldie. It's a kind of T-shaped device. It has a wide base, a narrow neck, and goes up to a lengthy top part, sort of like a candlestick or a chalice. And on the top is a text light display that shows bits of text, kind of like on a bus stop or a tube station, scrolling across. And the text comes both from news feeds from 25 news sites around the world and also from a website called We Feel Fine, which itself looks for sentences that include the words I feel, drawn from social network sites like Facebook or blogs or Twitter.
And I gather there is limited success. One of the nuns got a bit fed up of a particular I feel dot 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 kind of message, wasn't it?
Well, in the beginning, the I feel messages were repeating themselves quite a bit. And in fact, a lot of them are fairly trivial. They, you know, people say, I feel hungry. I feel like my hair is a mess. And so they thought those were quite indulgent. They didn't know how to pray for them.
And I know that I feel fine site. And it's one of my favourites. I love it. There's a lot of kind of trivial stuff like, you know, I feel 18. But quite, you know, people can be saying things like, I feel desperate. I feel depressed. I mean, some of them are quite heartrending. And I suppose those kinds of I feels the nuns would resonate with. And it might hopefully stimulate some prayer and some reflection.
That's what's happened. And that's what they've reported happening. I have to say that they know that people feel lonely and they know that people feel sad sometimes. So even then, you know, they don't necessarily need reminding. But they've more and more, I think, they've started to look at those and actually pray for the people on behalf of the people who are making those statements.
As for these news feeds that you've been sending through to the nuns, have they been made more aware of some of the breaking stories and some of the distressing stories around? I'm thinking maybe like the Haiti earthquake, those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that they already had access to a degree through the radio and the internet, But this device sits in a very public area, so they happen upon it quite often during the day. And so they'll see these news stories come as they occur. And the headlines, the news feed changes over the course of a story, so let's see how it develops over time. Any number of times they've seen things on the prayer companion, which they can then pray for immediately, as it were.
As for the wider context to this project then, how important has it been to you as researchers? At Goldsmiths, you're very interested in bringing design and technology together. Well, what have you learned? What have you had cause to reflect on? What's troubled you about it? What kind of conclusions would you have?
It's quite unusual for people to build technologies that go outside our normal concern with work or entertainment or communication and to look at kind of a wider range of human values. And this sort of spirituality is certainly one of them. And so we feel very proud that we've done a piece that really aids the non-spirituality in a way that they recognize as their own, not an imposition upon them. The only thing that's been a little distressing to me is to be very careful about in some way breaking their vow of enclosure. Some of the press attention we've been getting has actually been a bit disturbing. So reporters have actually come in and contacted the nuns themselves, inviting themselves over and actually managed to get the nuns to bring them into their enclosure to take photographs and so forth. The nuns are okay with that, but it makes me somewhat uncomfortable because I feel like through this project, we may be in some way impinging upon the vows they've taken.
That is Bill Gaver. Bill Thompson is here. And what's your take on this? It's effectively like a filtering service, like a news filtering service for nuns.
I think it's a very sympathetic design. And it's interesting to see how Bill Gaver and his team have taken on what is a very difficult problem and come up with such an imaginative solution. I mean, you know, I'm an atheist myself. I don't actually believe in prayers of intercession, but I do think that people should have technologies in their lives that serve them and that don't change their lives too much. And it's clear that what the nuns needed was some way of knowing what's happening in the world without it getting in the way to guide them. And by doing it in this way, I think sort of Gaver and his team are giving them, you know, a perfect device for their mode of existence, because it is. It's searching the net on their behalf, and I'm sure they could improve the software that actually does the filtering to have a proper software agent, so it's not just looking for I feel. And then it's presenting in a way which, as we heard, is unobtrusive but effective. And it's so important for designers to be able to step back and look at the problem that their potential users have rather than just impose their own view on coming up with a solution. And that's clearly what's happened here.
And what I liked about it is it's something of an antithesis of this whole so-called Web 2.0 approach of this two-way flow of information. Nobody's expecting the nuns necessarily to feed back into the process other than spiritually.
I was going to say they are feeding back. I mean,
feeding back to
the nuns,
you know,
think
I mean,
they're feeding back because they're changing the way God looks at the people who are unhappy. And I think that's a very effective feedback loop for them.
All I mean is they're not just doing it, typing it back into an iPhone. In fact, they're doing it on a higher plane, a higher level, as it were.
And the technology that's been offered to them makes that possible.
Okay, well, in fact, that, as I was saying in the introduction, that whole project comes about from initial work that was looking into technology and the elderly. And that's a topic that's going to be discussed on this week's edition, and is being discussed on this week's edition of our sister programme, Click. It's the BBC's TV technology programme. And you can find out more about that via bbc.co.uk/click. Now, if you're into the idea of knowing where complete strangers live, like, you know, where they are at the moment, those kinds of things, maybe who they hang out with, who they go for lunch with, well, there is a stalking website to help you. Now, before you sound too horrified, the site has actually been specifically set up to help us all think about privacy and to draw attention to the information that we inadvertently give away when we do things like posting photos online. It's basically another bit of so-called hacker culture, not to do with malevolently breaking into government mainframes, but with a social conscience, helping society, doing good things, albeit often with a rather mischievous, edgy and geeky slant. Stalking was a talking point at the recent HOPE event in New York, where HOPE stands for Hackers on Planet Earth. 3,000 hackers were there, and Digital Planet's Laura Sheeter went along to speak to delegates and organisers.
HOPE is... it's probably 2 years of college in one weekend, and the greatest party you'll ever attend. It's just an adventure to come every time we hold it.
CQ, this is November 2 Hotel, special event station for the Hackers on Planet Earth Conference at the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York City. This is November 2.
If you thought hacking was just about computers and the internet, well, think again. with the smell of hot soldering irons in the air and bits of circuit board and wire covering tables in this room. There are people sitting down trying to make new things out of almost anything you can imagine, and more gadgets and gizmos than I've ever seen. This, the Hackerspace, is the heart of the HOPE conference, where more than 3,000 people over 3 days have gathered to talk about what they do, what's new, and what the future holds in technology. Privacy is one of the biggest themes being discussed. Do we have any? Do we want any? And if so, how can we get some? One speaker, Ben Jackson, set up a website to show people posting photos online they could be publishing far more information than they realised.
With these photos being instantly published online, we wondered how easy it would be to be able to track people and know where people are in near real time. And it turns out that it was quite easy to find this out, unfortunately. We set up a website called icanstalkyou.com. And what we started doing is we started looking at Twitter for people posting these types of images. And we set up, when people say, you know, here's my lunch right today, we have on our website, you say, what they're really saying is, I'm currently at this location.
Using the GPS data embedded in photos, Ben could track people he'd never met and find out where they lived, worked, and hung out with their friends. His website tells people how to wipe the information off their photos before they put them online. Other talks suggested ways to confuse facial recognition cameras and evade data profiling by search engines. It's a topic people are keen to discuss.
I mean, I think the whole point of the whole conference is about people keeping technology in their own hands. So much in the modern world, corporate interests want to try to exclude the public from participation in the technical creation process. And so this is all about just learning how to do it yourself.
It's all about more power to the people and all of us coming together and achieving similar goals.
I'm retired from the Navy, where I was a cryptologist. Main point here in some of the lectures upstairs and what have you, don't use your computer.
Compelled, I don't believe, is too strong a word.
Of course, hacking can be controversial and take you to the wrong side of the law, and the conference didn't shy away from that. One fierce debate about hackers as informants included a hacker who had turned someone in to the US government for allegedly leaking thousands of classified documents. HOPE's founder, Emmanuel Goldstein, says such face-to-face discussions are vital to the hacker community and demonstrate its radical spirit.
We are willing to hear all different sides and come to our own conclusions rather than be told what it is we must think and what we have to decide. Hackers have never been very good at following rules. We tend to question a lot. We tend to break the rules because oftentimes they don't make sense, or oftentimes we want to try something different and see how that works. And of course, the people who are most upset by that are the ones in charge, the ones who prefer the status quo. But the hacker spirit pretty much mandates that we have to question all sides, including our own, and simply try things in as many different ways as possible. We're getting to the quote-unquote average people. If you look at any movie where there's a hacker character, invariably they're the hero. And invariably the audience is cheering for them to break the rules, to ask all the inconvenient questions. I think that says something about the individualistic nature in all of us, not just in hackers.
Emmanuel Goldstein, ending that report from Laura Sheeter. Bill, you're waving your keys around here, and I think you've got a hacker point to make about them.
I do. Here's my key ring. And sitting on it is a new smart key, a little key fob that comes from the new London cycle hire scheme. Because in London now, there are these bikes that you can borrow just for an hour or a day or whatever. You pay for them. And I signed up for the scheme the day it started, and they sent me this smart key fob, which I put into the machine and it unlocks my bike and it tracks my journeys. And really, this is exactly the sort of thing that Emmanuel Goldstein there is talking about. This is a piece of technology that has been handed to me. I've been given no understanding of how it all works, what the systems are behind it. And my instinct is to want to know more. And I'm sure it will not be long before I'll be able to get a little device that will read the contents of this, not so I can break the system, but so I can understand what I've signed up for, so that I can be in slightly more control over the data that is being held about me and used on my behalf. And the hacker culture is really about that. It's about having the knowledge that allows us to control our destiny in this technological world.
Bill, thank you very much indeed.
BBC.
This is Digital Planet. We're on the radio, we're online, and we're on your MP3 player. It all originates from the BBC World Service here in London. And I'm Gareth Mitchell. And don't go away, or you'll miss a quick visit to Kampala, home to a hotbed of ideas and top techie talent. Not to be missed. So, with a bit of help from the hackers just there, we were looking at privacy issues, and kind of appropriate, really, because I did an interview earlier where I wasn't the only one recording it. So was the guest. Very weird. He turned up wearing a camera and an audio recorder, and they captured the whole conversation. Now, he was Gordon Bell, a principal researcher for Microsoft based in the firm's San Francisco labs. He's also something of a Silicon Valley stalwart, having written an early blueprint for what became the internet in his days at the National Science Foundation. These days, Gordon doesn't go around recording conversations just to stalk people. He's capturing every aspect and moment of his existence to explore how storage and search technologies are converging to offer digital archives of all our lives. It's part of a 10-year experiment called My Life Bits that Gordon has documented in his book, Total Recall. Gordon's side of our interview is now, no doubt, on one of his enormous hard drives, but here's the side that we recorded.
The view I have is actually that the electronic memory is the true memory, and that our biomemory is really a URL into the e-memory.
Gordon, why the interest in the notion of the e-memory?
It all started with a statement by Bill Gates in 1995. He wrote in a book, "Someday you will be able to record everything you see and hear." In fact, I found out we had very good technology to capture most of life, but then I got into the issue of, well, how do you ever get it back? People who do this really become kind of a librarian of their lives.
So this ongoing archive, it's growing all the time. As we sit here doing this interview, you have two gadgets there on lanyards just around your neck. Talk us through what these two things are.
First off, the SenseCam. It records an image every 20 seconds. So you have basically a time lapse of an episode or of a day or whatever, as much as you want to record.
Okay, yeah, it looks like a little camera, you know, rather kind of unfussy.
Yes.
Okay, low-tech, if I can put it like that, camera. But it has the lens. So you're saying, as we sit here now, it's taking pictures of us a few times every minute.
Yes. With that, you can sort of get an idea of what a day was like. And then the lower unit here is really just a standard digital voice recorder.
You're taking an audio recording, you're taking all these pictures on a quite regular basis. They all feed into the memory. And that's important to you then, Gordon, isn't it? So you're not just archiving text and pictures, but also audio, maybe bits of video here and there.
Yes.
You're keen on bringing all these things together, these different modalities.
That sort of became known as kind of life logging. I'm totally convinced that probably within a decade that you will be able to wear a button or whatever that has both of these devices in them, and that will be a life memory of everything you've heard and seen, should you choose to do it.
You're setting yourself up as a lab, in a way, and I assume that part of it is to try and get your head around these issues, to find out how it actually feels to be recording pretty much second by second, or at least minute by minute, your every waking hour.
In a way, it's enabled me to offload my brain.
How about the ethical side of things then? Because you sat here, you've started recording this conversation, you haven't asked for my permission. I mean, I don't mind. We're recording you back, it's fine. But there must be conversations you have where people might not realise that you're photographing them and recording them. Do you always point out to them that everything is being set down on the record?
I think we're okay on the visual, strangely enough, but the audio is always is problematic. One of the parts of the experiment was to record telephone conversations. And in that case, things were very clear. When somebody would call me, a message came up and said, "I'm recording this." And then similarly, you know, I would call somebody and I would start with that preamble. I think the real reason is that all the information is in the audio channel. And in fact, I've been an advocate from the beginning with the SenseCam of putting audio in the SenseCam. And the people building the SenseCam have been equally adamant that we shouldn't put audio in the SenseCam because of the legal aspects of it.
Are there potential neurological benefits, this therapeutic benefits to this kind of recall technology?
Really, with the origin of SenseCam, it was as a memory aid, but it turned out that the first uses were for neurological work to aid people who had an impaired memory. In fact, the first use was with a woman who had encephalitis, so, and had lost a significant part of her memory, and she wears it all the time. And then in a way, it's kind of all of that is creating kind of a screensaver for life.
Gordon Bell, so Bill Thompson, this fusing, this melding, this symphony between biomemory and computer memory.
I think Gordon's work is really important, but this confusion between what is memory actually annoys me because the data stored on a hard drive or on a flash memory is not memory in the sense of human memory in your mind, inhering in your brain. It just isn't, because it operates in such completely different ways. And storing the ones and zeros, storing the bits, is really important, and they can be used to stimulate and correct your memories. But to say, as he did, that our biomemory is really just a URL into our real memory is to distort the language, use the words inappropriately, and I think actually to mislead people who are listening to that.
But Bill, you've got your array of gadgets and iPads and goodness knows what else here. If somebody says to you, how much storage does that have? Will you make the point, this is storage, that's not memory? I bet in a computer context you have used the word memory when actually storage.
Of course I have, because the word memory is the word being used. What's wrong is not his use of the word, but the context within which he uses it. You know, frankly, why didn't you bring his hard drive along today? You could have just sat it there and we could have interviewed that. Why is that different from having the man? Well, possibly because he's an organic being. His brain is actually running. His synapses are changing. All those fine things are happening inside his head. When a human being knows something, that's known within a broader context. That's how symbolic manipulation works. You don't offload your memory. You may put into bits something which will then remind you when you need it, because human memory is imperfect. But that's not crossing that very important category between real memory and what the computer stores.
All very memorable stuff. Thanks very much, Bill. Now, looking out for the next Mark Zuckerberg, possibly. Maybe there's a Sergey Brin out there or a Mark Shuttleworth. Will they be found in the Ugandan capital, Kampala? Well, perhaps they'll emerge from a new workspace and community in the city called the Hive Collaborative Space, or Hive Collab for short. And it might be a chance to improve on the currently rather low percentage of computer graduates in the region who end up actually working in technology. Hive Collab launched at the beginning of July. So with workstations and local entrepreneurs now properly installed, reporter Vishva Samani has dropped in for a look round.
I'm on the outskirts of Kampala, standing in front of a large pink building, inside which is hidden an office space where the cream of Uganda's technology community gather to develop what they hope will be the next big thing.
My name is John Gosier. I'm the CEO of Africa Labs and one of the co-founders of Hive Workspace.
Using his personal savings as startup capital, John launched a type of technology incubator, now known as the Hive Collab. It provides budding entrepreneurs with investment capital, a stable salary, and the kind of training and mentorship that Western entrepreneurs often take for granted. Kampala's Makerere University produces 900 computer science graduates every year, but of those, only 5 to 10% find jobs in the field.
The main job avenues for people who've graduated and who are well-trained are to work for the local telecoms. Fairly good opportunities. I think those opportunities are lacking is the space to be creative. It's also common for people who are highly skilled, when they can't find work, to just become whatever they can find. So they might sell t-shirts, they might become boda drivers, they might work at restaurants, which is unfortunate because these are actually very well-trained people. There's just not that opportunity to sustain themselves.
The doors at Hive Collab are not just open to anyone. Young tech entrepreneurs have to apply with their project ideas before being accepted to use the workspace. Moses Magisha is one such tech entrepreneur who uses the Hive. He was contracted by a New York Times journalist to develop an anti-corruption database to help journalists investigate companies and governments internationally.
He had this idea of like people always interested in knowing how the aid is being spent. This is the information which is freely available on the web, but like if you can amalgamate it in one place so that if someone is looking for it, you can easily find it, because like when you find it on several websites, it's always hidden under several layers, like you have to click, click, click.
For many who use the Hive, developing software that addresses African social issues is important. Emmanuel Luca is a recent graduate. He worked on a rapid SMS application with UNICEF.
It's a tool that UNICEF contracted us to do monitoring for Rwanda, and mainly the monitoring birth rates for pregnant women, and then childbirth and so forth. So they had lots of this data that was coming in, and they had reporters right in the field who would just send information using a code via a phone, and it would come onto a central server where it could be monitored, responses could be done, and so forth, yeah.
But the Hive collab is not just attracting boys to muck around with their toys. Barbara Wirenji is a local web designer who uses the space.
How did I come to like web design? It was actually all about Privileged, a season I watched, and there was a cool app about designing clothes, actually designing your clothes online before you actually wear them. So yeah, I kind of liked that and thought I could do something like that. That's how I got into web design.
She's keen to work on encouraging more Ugandan women to embrace technology.
There's something in Kenya called Akira Chicks. It's about web developer ladies. So I'm actually thinking of coming up with something like that, Ugandan version, to encourage ladies in development, because in Uganda there are not so many.
Whilst projects are sometimes slow to get off the ground here, locally well-established web developers are grateful for the Hive. Ugandan blogger and developer Solomon King anticipates big ideas will ultimately spring forth from local tech talent in Uganda.
The rate of development is very high. We are looking at groups like the Google Technology Users Group. We have the Linux Users Group. We have all sorts of little communities that are forming themselves around their passions. It may not be on a large scale, but the little pockets of technology are coming together to form something that's going to be phenomenal.
That's Solomon King talking to Vishva Samani in Uganda. And that's it for this week. We will have more Digital Planet for you next week. But for now, from me, Gareth Mitchell, and producer Colin Grant and Bill Thompson, of course, thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
BBC.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from the BBC. Digital Planet is one of a host of programmes from BBC Science. So, if you like this, then why not listen to our weekly news roundup of developments in Science in Action, and also Discovery, our science documentary.